I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Today, how the electric guitar took over the world and became an international symbol of freedom, danger, and rebellion. From Chuck Berry to the Beatles, we'll listen to the riffs that rocked the world and hear the stories behind them. Then, how the murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till in 1955 changed the civil rights movement forever. We'll speak with a man who thoroughly documented the case 60 years later, and we'll learn how big names like Jay-Z and Will Smith are now getting involved. Later, this week's edition of Statehouse Blend, Kansas. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning. Let's let no less an authority than Carlos Santana, whose music we're hearing right now, describe the impact of the instrument known as the electric guitar. He writes this: to be able to touch someone and change their molecular structure with just one note is very powerful. One note can bring someone back from the edge, make lovers come together, create life and wars, and make you shed tears of joy and sorrow all at the same time. It is called, he says, the universal tone. This morning, a conversation about the history and impact of that beast called the electric guitar. With us is Alan DiPerna. He's co-author of a fascinating new book, Play It Loud, An Epic History of the Style, Sound, and Revolution of the Electric Guitar. He's also a longtime contributor to Guitar World and Guitar Aficionado. Alan, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be here.
Why does this sound resonate with us to the extent that it does?
Well, it's kind of embedded in our culture by this point. You know, mm-hmm. The electric guitar has been around for a good 80 years or so, and it's really found a place for itself, or a place has been found for it, and in virtually every vernacular music genre that we have, certainly rock and roll music in all its permutations, but also soul, funk, reggae, country, blues, you name it.
It can do so much, you're saying, right? It can do so much.
It's a very versatile instrument by nature of its design. You know, you're converting physical string vibrations into an electrical signal that, you know, once it's in that domain, anything can be done to it tonally, and a lot has been done to it over the years.
You know, in your book, you take us to Hollywood to give us the man who invented the electric guitar, or at least made a major contribution here. He was a refugee from Texas, and his name was George Delmencia Beauchamp, if I'm saying that right. Who was he?
Oh, well, actually, it's pronounced Beecham, which is weird.
Beecham. Okay.
Yeah, because it's spelled like the French Beauchamp, so you think. But no, it was a family from Texas. He was a guitar player who, just like guitar players today, make their way from more rural parts of the country, of the world, to big major entertainment centers, which in the 1920s, the period we're talking about, was Hollywood, for sure. The film industry had recently relocated from New York to Hollywood. He came to town, found work as a vaudeville guitar player, did Hawaiian music, which was a hugely popular genre at that time. It's difficult to understand today, like just how big Hawaiian music was. But he made his mark there, and he found himself confronted with the same problem that a lot of guitarists were finding themselves confronted with, is that in a larger band setting or orchestral setting, the instrument just wasn't loud enough. When you're competing with a piano, with a horn section, any ensemble of instruments like that, mm-hmm. you know, basically the guitar doesn't cut it. It had recently taken over from the banjo as kind of the plucked string rhythm instrument of choice. And, you know, the banjo has a bit louder acoustic tone. So Beecham was one of several people trying to figure out how to amplify the guitar. People weren't only looking at the guitar in the 1920s. There were also efforts to electrify the piano, the violin. But, you know, for some reason, there's just something about the intrinsic design of the guitar that seemed more amenable to electrification, I think. So
he wanted it to be louder then.
Essentially louder, yeah. And then once you get to louder, there's a whole range of tonal possibilities that are suddenly there that hadn't been there before.
But, how did he do it?
He did it by basically... Well, as I said, converting the physical vibration of a string into a disruption of a magnetic field into an electrical signal via something called a pickup. Beecham was the guy who figured out that what you needed to be focusing on with the pickup is the string itself. Traditional guitar design said that the top of the guitar, you know, the part that has the big round hole in it or the F holes in it, is the source of vibration. So people were trying to attach electrical pickups to that, to, you know, different parts of the instrument. But, you know, Beecham's simple but brilliant revelation really is that the string is the thing. It's the most immediate source of vibration. So he started working with a phonograph pickup, actually. This is also the era when the old Edison Victrolas were being replaced by, electronic phonographs. So he started fooling with that and eventually perfected a design. And by 1932 had, you know, what's regarded as the first commercially produced electric guitar on the market, the Ropatin A25, known as the frying pan, because it had a small round body and a big long neck, so it kind of looked like a frying pan.
You know, one thing I really liked about this book is you get a sense reading it that, you know, it's one contribution leading to another, both in the invention of the electric guitar and then the music that was played on it as well. I mean, the sound we hear from a group like Led Zeppelin never would have happened if folks like Joe Walsh hadn't come along, that one contributed to the next.
Oh, yeah, it's a real kind of chain. It's a real, you know, brotherhood and sisterhood, if you will, of both players and inventors, you know. And yeah, there's all these kind of fortuitous things. The Led Zeppelin sound, or, you know, the sound of hard rock, or you know, any music in that genre, Hendrix, is, you know, the result of a couple of different things. Jimmy Page was primarily playing a Gibson Les Paul, a guitar that had been introduced in 1952 and initially wasn't very successful. By 1961, it had gone out of production. But some of the rock players, rock and blues players, like Mike Bloomfield, Eric Clapton, picked it up once again and put it together with a new type of amplifier that had come along in England, the Marshall amp, which had been very much developed at the behest of Pete Townsend of The Who, who went into Jim Marshall, the music store owner in London, and said, look, you know, I need a better amp. He brought his old Fender amp in, plunked it down on the counter, and said, I want this twice as loud. So again, it was sort of a quest for volume, but had these little, you know, had Jimmy Page not plug that Gibson Les Paul into that particular Marshall amp, yeah, the whole, you know, we would be listening to a very different style of rock music today.
You know, Alan, you mentioned Les Paul. What did he bring us? Because I think it has to do with the importance of a log, like a wooden log. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, Les was one of several people who were experimenting with solid body guitar designs. You have to remember that, you know, the guitar as it comes down to us from history is a hollow body instrument. It's a big hollow box, basically, with a neck and strings attached to it. And the purpose of that hollow box is to amplify the sound acoustically. Well, once you've got electrical amplification, once you've got pickups and an amp, you don't need the big old box anymore. And in fact, the big old box is going to cause problems, such as feedback and unwanted sort of, you know, tonal howling sounds and everything. which in later years, you know, people like Jimi Hendrix would discover uses for these seemingly unwanted sounds. But at that time, it was not something you wanted. So, yeah, Les was one of the people who said, well, if we go to just a solid plank of wood, then we are isolating that all-important string vibration from the physical vibration of the instrument. A lot of people think Les originated that idea. He did not. 1935, there was already a solid-body guitar on the market called the Slingerland Songster, which is not too well known, but it's clearly a predecessor of Les Paul's Log, which dates from about 1941. But so, you know, Les was one of those players who also was looking at the physical and the technical characteristics of the instrument, looking at how they could be modified. And he was also a great entertainer, a great storyteller. So he was one of those figures who was on the radio very early playing the electric guitar. And of course, when television came along in the middle of the 20th century, he was one of the first people on television with an electric guitar. So, So in addition to his technical contributions and his great musical contributions, fantastic player, he also was he's a bit of a huckster, quite honestly. But he was a great ambassador for the electric guitar.
Alan DePerna is my guest. He's co-author of a new book, Play It Loud, An Epic History of the Style, Sound, and Revolution of the Electric Guitar. How about Muddy Waters' contribution?
Oh, Muddy Waters' contribution was also really immense. I mean, here was another player from Mississippi who started out as an acoustic blues player, playing, you know, the traditional Delta style, made his way to Chicago, in his instance, a big city, part of the great African-American migration up north at that time, in the 1940s. And Muddy put together the first all-electric band, basically. He switched from his acoustic guitar to a Fender Telecaster. It was one of the earlier players to embrace the Telecaster. And, basically the whole Chicago blues style originates with, you know, the work of people like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. This style, of course, gets picked up by people like the Rolling Stones and Eric Clapton in England, who seek to emulate, you know, the sounds that they're hearing from these Chess records, which were, you know, we have to remember, which were records that were mainly made for the African American community at the time. They were not mass culture hits in the way that, you know, the music of the Stones and Clapton would become. But all roads in contemporary rock, you could say, kind of lead us back to Muddy Waters.
How about Chuck Berry? And I want to play a little bit of Johnny B. Goode in the background here. What did he do?
Well, Chuck. There it is.
There he is.
Yeah. Chuck was one of the guys. Coincidentally enough, one of the things Chuck did when he came to Chicago is he went to see his hero, Muddy Waters, and he said, well, you know, I'm a guitar player, I write songs, I sing, I want to make a career in music, what should I do? Muddy tells him, well, you have to go see Chess Records, the Chess Brothers, over in Chicago, which was the label that was putting out these great Muddy Waters records, Howlin' Wolf. So, you know, Chuck goes to them. He had one foot in the African American blues, you know, blues and R&B tradition, but there was also a kind of country influence. A song called Ida Red became one of his big hits, Maybelline, Twisted Around. And I remember Ike Turner said that, from Ike and Tina Turner said that, you know, that when he first heard it, you know, somebody told him, this is a black guy, he couldn't believe it. He thought it was like some white guy from the country. So Chuck, you know, and amazing synthesis of these kind of two main styles that go to make up rock and roll music, you know, blues and country, you know, had a baby, basically, and they called it rock and roll. To this, he adds a phenomenal gift and capability as a lyricist, as an ability to tell stories in song. And you know, one of the great stories he tells is of Johnny B. Goode, who's kind of the archetypal quintessential guitar hero. This, you know, poor boy from the wrong side of the tracks. He doesn't have much money. He carries his guitar around in a, you know, in a burlap sack. But man, he can play the guitar, and as a result, you know, it's this kind of rags to riches, Horatio Alger kind of thing. But you know, cast in musical terms, cast in terms of, you know, you could say African American empowerment.
Right.
So you know, Chuck Berry is another one of those guys, hugely important.
You go on to Eric Clapton, Eddie Van Halen, and you get the sense that these guys, they were like tinkerers, almost the same way that some guys mess around with hot rods, Alan.
Definitely, yeah. And there's a real kind of parallel. I mean, you know, Van Halen's coming up in Southern California, which is also the seat of, you know, hot rod culture, car culture, this idea of, in our own time, you know, you could say, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, Les Paul was the guy who said, okay, let's take this instrument apart and break it down to its component parts and put it together in a new way. But, you know, in the mid to late 70s, Eddie Van Halen was the guy who was... He was not satisfied with the quality of American-made guitars at the time. Both Fender and Gibson had taken a bit of a downward turn. Both had been taken over. You know, Leo Fender sold to CBS in 1965. Fender had come under... Gibson had also come under corporate control. And what corporate people want to do, unfortunately, is, you know, cut corners so they could put more money in their pocket. So, you know, quality of the instruments started to go down. Van Halen just started to, you know, fool around with, you know, swapping out different pickups, different, you know, different parts of the guitars. He wanted some qualities of the Fender. He would combine with other qualities of the Gibson design of guitars. So he, you know, put together what's, you know, called the, you know, the Frankenstrat or the, you know, or the Frankenstein Stratocaster. And you really touched off a whole, in the 80s, it was all about hot rodding, you know, your instrument.
You know, you guys write that the British invasion, I love this analogy, the British invasion was to guitar music roughly what the Gutenberg Bible and advent of printing had been to literacy. So let's talk about that. What did the Beatles add to the equation?
What the Beatles added to the
I'm going to play I Feel Fine in just a minute here.
All right, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Yeah, what the Beatles added was, well, you know, prior to them in rock music and in popular music generally, the focus was on a singer, Elvis Presley, Bing Crosby, whoever it may be. Instrumentalists were in the background. They were accompanists. The Beatles were, you know, not the first, but, you know, one of the first self-contained guitar, electric guitar playing groups. They wrote their own songs, which was also really, really revolutionary. You know, at the time it was much more common for a professional songwriter to create a song that an A&R person then put together with the correct artist who, you know, sang the song. The Beatles blew all that out the window. They very quickly convinced their producer, George Martin, that, hey, our song is just as good as the one that you've lined up for us. Perhaps it's even better. So here's this group of, you know, four young men who, you know, playing their own instruments, writing their own songs. Many kids out in the suburbs and the hinterlands and the cities in America and England and Europe, all across the world. And I was one of them, started saying, hey, you know, we can do this. You know, let's, you know, look, you know, you can get a guitar in the Sears catalog for whatever it was back then, you know, 80 bucks or something. And let's, you know, let's get together in the garage and, you know, try to play some of these songs. You know, some of them weren't that difficult to play. You didn't have to go to Juilliard, you know, to be able to play Johnny Be Good or Louie Louie or one of those kinds of songs.
Were they the first group to use guitar feedback in recorded music? They weren't, were they?
Absolutely, yeah.
They were.
Yeah. It is I Feel Fine. Yeah, that...
Here we go. We're going to listen to it right now.
Yeah.
Baby's good to me. You know she's happy as can be. You know she said so. I'm in love with her.
And where's the feedback in that, Alan?
Oh, We missed it. It's the very first note of the song.
Yeah, I thought we missed it. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That little quick introduction, right? I'll ask our Linda if she can grab that first bit of the music there. Maybe we can try it again. Let's see if we can get it here and listen. I want to catch that because I thought we missed it.
Yeah. Just the very first note.
No, we don't have it. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It must be an edit. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Let's.
It's there on the original.
There you go. Well, I want to move on to page 189 in the book, because you write this on this page. If a poll were taken to determine the single most influential electric guitar performance in the instrument's entire history, the majority of votes would most likely go to this tour de force musical moment. And I'm talking about Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock and his playing of the Star Spangled Banner. Let's listen just a little bit of that. Why is this moment so highly regarded, Alan?
Well, it was the height of the Vietnam era.
Right.
Resistance to the Vietnam War was really at a fever pitch. It was the Woodstock Festival, which was kind of the culmination of this whole hippie scene, which had come together. 66, 67, building momentum. It had really become a huge thing. Hendrix at the time was probably the biggest, most significant rock performer at the time. He gets on stage, he does his set. It's early in the morning, actually, because Woodstock, as most people know, is so horribly disorganized.
And this song wasn't rehearsed, was it?
No. Hendrix may have started to fool around with it a bit, but I talked to Billy Cox, the bass player, and
because you can hear Billy Cox starting to play along with him, but then he stops, recognizing smartly
notes,
that this song is something extraordinary here.
Right. Yeah. So Hendrix goes into this thing and basically without saying a word, makes it a protest song. He makes a statement about what was going on in the world, in America at the time, in incorporating the sounds of bombs blasting, of the ambulance siren. He basically plunges us into the hellish chaos of war, juxtaposed with the American national anthem, this kind of glorious battle hymn of victory.
And not surprisingly, a lot of Americans were hugely upset at what he had done here.
Yes, there was outcry that he had, shown disrespect for the country or its national anthem. And at the time, for an African American to speak out on political issues was not something that happened frequently. Performers still had to be careful. Muhammad Ali was outspoken. The Black Panthers were on the scene, but. To make that kind of political statement was bold, and Hendrix kind of the quote is in the book. I forgot his exact words, but he just said, "Hey, I'm an American, and he says, "Well, it's kind of like go America, go," but we play it the way things are in America right now, and right now in America the air is a little staticky, so that's why we play it that way. But there was outcry, but on the other hand, those who were opposed to the war, particularly young people of the counterculture, they knew what was going on. I mean, they didn't need to read the paper the next morning to have that explained to them.
Alan DePerna's new book, Play It Loud, An Epic History of the Style, Sound, and Revolution of the Electric Guitar. And Alan, I wish we had more time. This is just a fascinating book. Really appreciate you taking some time with us.
Oh, hey, Steve. Great to be here, and I'm always happy to talk about the electric guitar.
Oh, it's a great topic. Thanks again, Alan.
You're welcome.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll discuss change topics dramatically, and we'll talk about Emmett Till and the murder that shocked the world. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, the future of transportation. Uber is hinting that flying cars may be closer than you think. Also, author Robert Kaplan's take on politics and foreign affairs. Well, it was the murder that had eyes and ears from around the world centered on Mississippi. In 1955, a young 14-year-old boy from Chicago named Emmett Till was forced by gunpoint from his uncle's house and brutally killed. His death and the acquittal of his killers by an all-white jury would set off a firestorm of protests and spur on the civil rights movement in the years to follow. It was a case set in time of unease and racial tension, a backdrop uncannily similar to today. Joining me is author Devery Anderson, who's written extensively on the Emmett Till case in his book, Emmett Till, The Murder That Shocked the World and Propelled the Civil Rights Movement. Devery, thanks for taking the time. So good to have you here.
Well, great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
A few months ago, HBO signed a miniseries that will be largely based off your book, and there's some big names producing this. For starters, Jay-Z and Will Smith. That's got to bring a lot of recognition to this important moment in history, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, for sure. And everybody's excited about the project. They're committed to it. HBO's committed to it, and it's 6 to 8 hours, I think it's going to be. And so they've got enough time to really tell the story in depth and to do it right, and I think it's exciting.
You open this prologue with a rather eerie epiphany that when you once had a chance to look into the glass of Emmett's coffin, you expected to see his corpse, but instead you saw your own reflection. What did that moment mean for you and for this book?
Well, it was a turning point in so many ways personally because I suddenly felt a part of history. The significance of that casket is that tens of thousands of people filed past that original casket in 1955, saw his mangled corpse and his battered face.
And it was battered is putting it mildly.
Right, yeah, he was beyond recognition.
Book. Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the casket was in the storage in the cemetery, and I stood there, and I tried to envision that, and personally, I felt suddenly, like I said, a part of that past, but the reflection that I saw just gave me a chance for self-reflection by looking at my own reflection. And it made me realize I was a historian at one level, but a human being at another. And I had to really deal with this case, I guess, in two ways, as a human being with feeling, who was traumatized myself over this past, that I didn't see it as it unfolded, but this is the type of case that you learn about it, you don't see it as history. When you learn about the Emmett Till case and experience that, you feel as though you're one of those people that was horrified at the time. That's the impact this has had for so long, and that's when it really hit me that that's how I was.
Why was his casket pulled out of the ground in 2004?
Well, the FBI opened an investigation of the murder in 2004, and as part of that investigation, they had to exhume the body and do an autopsy because the defense argued in 55 that this body wasn't Emmett Till. Nobody could identify it, and they wanted to be able to settle that now. And so they did the autopsy. When they reburied him, they put him in a new casket. The original, because of its significance, went into storage with the intent of being in a museum in the Chicago cemetery. That didn't work out, but it's now in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
No kidding. Well, Emmett Till was 14 when he visited Money, Mississippi. You describe him as a city boy from Chicago and mention that his arrival couldn't have come at a worse time. What was going on in Mississippi back then?
Well, we have to go back a year earlier when the Supreme Court ruled on the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which outlawed segregation in public schools. And the South wasn't ready for a decision like that. And so the backlash was just tremendous.
Yeah,
throughout the South, but in Mississippi especially. And as a result of that, citizens' councils rose up all over the state. And their mission was to fight this case and to get it overturned. Really, you know, come what may. They were willing to do just about anything to make sure that integration never became the norm in Mississippi. The fear of having the races together in schools because they feared the result of that would be interracial marriage. And so lynchings, which there hadn't been a recorded lynching since 1951, and suddenly, just before Emmett Till had arrived, there had been two others that occurred, one in May of 55 and one in August, and these were men who were active in voter registration, and they saw that if blacks could vote, they could have a say in politics, segregation would be a thing of the past. As long as blacks had no say, they could delay segregation or integration forever. And so the tension, and then the gubernatorial race was going on right then. In fact, the day that Emmett Till had his encounter that led to his death, the state of Mississippi's election chose a new governor. The five people who were in the running over that course of that election all ran on a segregationist platform. They were trying to outdo each other on segregation. And so the tension was high. And then Emmett Till comes to town.
And the accounts then are disputed about what happened here. But tell us how all this started. It's an encounter between Emmett, again, he's 14 years old, and a young woman named Carolyn Bryant, who was with her husband. What happened?
Right. She, in this little town of Money, Mississippi, the Bryant Grocery and Meat Market, a little store that catered to field hands and sharecroppers for their supplies and that. Emmett and his cousins had been picking cotton earlier in the day. They went there for some refreshments in the evening. Emmett went in to buy some bubble gum. Being from the north, he didn't really understand. He was kind of a show-off by nature. As he left, after he left the store, he wolf-whistled at Carolyn Bryant. And that scared his cousins to death. They got in the car and left. He didn't really know what he had done, but when he saw their reaction, he realized that, wow, I broke a taboo. And 3 days later, as a result of that whistle, he was kidnapped from his uncle's home by the woman's husband and his brother. Mm-hmm. And brutally murdered.
There's no question he wolf whistled then. I've heard different things over the years about that.
Right. Some people have thought that he didn't intend to whistle or that he was just relieving a stutter that he had. And he did have a stutter. But his cousins who were with him have been adamant for all these years. And they were very clear to the press within a couple of days after this that Emmett did. It was in front of too many witnesses to really be in dispute that he intended to whistle at her. Just an innocent flirtation. Shouldn't have led to anything, but can't deny that he did that, but we also realize it's not a punishment that, or not a crime, and didn't deserve what happened.
Who found Emmett Till's body, and where was it?
It was in the Tallahatchie River. It was found 3 days after the kidnapping. A young fisherman, a 17-year-old fisherman named Robert Hodges, was just in his boat in the river, and he looked in the distance and saw a pair of knees protruding from the water, and then called the sheriff from there, and it was discovered.
In the book, you include, I mentioned, a picture of Emmett's corpse at his funeral, his body brutalized, yet his mom still insisted on an open casket funeral in Chicago. Why is that?
Well, she knew she couldn't really describe what had happened, that people would have to see it for themselves. And they did. Jet Magazine and the Black Press, Chicago Defender, published this picture. And the reaction was immediate, and people really had never seen anything like this, and it did lead to international coverage of the case, especially during the trial.
The jury then acquitted these two men who were accused of the murder, leading to a firestorm of protests afterwards. The choice of jurors was significant. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, Mississippi law didn't allow women to be on juries. You had to be a registered voter, and so there wasn't one black registered voter in Mississippi, and so the jury was going to be all white and all male. And it took a day and a half to select the jury because they had to weed out so many people that they could tell had prejudices that could influence their decision. Kind of backfired, though, because the district attorney wanted to pick people who didn't know Milam and Bryant, so these were the accused killers, because they thought they would be less apt to acquit in that case. But the people who knew them were the ones that didn't like them. And so by getting people from a certain part of the county where they were unfamiliar with them, kind of backfired. And so we had this white male jury of people who didn't really know, hadn't heard of these men, didn't know what they were like, didn't know their family background and that. And so it all came together to make it ripe for an acquittal.
You know, William Faulkner, the famous writer from Mississippi, responded to the case in a letter saying this: if we in America have reached the point in our desperate culture when we must murder children, no matter for what reason or what color, we don't deserve to survive. And you wonder what William Faulkner would say today.
Exactly. And he was such an insightful voice, especially at the time, being a native Mississippian. And he would say the same thing as far as, you know, everything that's happened since. And this is the kind of case that he had the foresight to be able to see what this would mean in the long run.
Devery Anderson will talk tonight at 6:30, the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch downtown. More information or to RSVP, you can go to kclibrary.org. You can also visit his website, emmettillmurder.com, for the latest updates and articles on the case. Devery, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
Again, his book, Emmett Till, The Murder That Shocked the World and Propelled the Civil Rights Movement. This week, State House Blend Kansas features a conversation about the future of education, public and otherwise, in Johnson County.
Introduce yourselves, please.
Dave Traubert, Kansas Policy Institute.
And Mark Tallman, Kansas Association of School Boards.
And joining Mark, Dave, and me at the Johnson County Public Library in Overland Park is my KCUR colleague, Ellie Moxley. Ellie, nice to have you back on the podcast.
Good evening, Sam.
Tonight, we cover a topic near and dear to most Kansans and certainly most folks in Johnson County. Are we spending enough on education, and what is the future of education? A lot to cover with all of you, as we've talked about. The topic is really sort of endless, but I want to bring Ellie in first and see what's on your mind.
You know, I feel like this election, education has become kind of a proxy for a lot of issues. I knocked on a lot of doors with a lot of candidates before the primary, and everyone was talking about Kansas schools. I mean, do you feel education policy, is it the biggest issue facing Kansas right now, or is it a place where a lot of maybe frustrations about government in general are going right now?
Well, a long time ago when I went to work for the School Board Association, my old executive director said, you know, school boards deal with money and kids, and those are the most important things to most people, hopefully not in that order. And so I think that our public education system, our school system, is always critically important. It's what we spend more money on. It employs more people than anything else in government. And I think we are at a point now where there is a lot of concern about kind of where we've been and where we're going, a lot of debate over that. And as we look around the state, there's no question that in many, many races, concern about education is a driving issue.
It is, and it should be. I think that's appropriate that it's a driving issue. We need to have strong achievement. I think one thing I would note is that while there's been a lot of discussion about school funding, and there should be, but unfortunately, that's not the big issue. We need to have more of a discussion about the outcomes. That, to me, is where we really have some achievement issues and borderline crisis, perhaps, in Kansas. The money has to be there, and we continue to set records. We, just this last fiscal year, set another school finance record for spending per pupil if you don't count CAPERS. And some people say you should, and some say you shouldn't. But even if you don't, it set another record last year. But there's a lot of money in the system. There's over $6 billion in the system. But the focus shouldn't be on money. Money's important. It has to be there. And it always will be there. It's always going to cost a lot. But what we really have to focus on, and very little discussion is held on it, is what are the kids actually achieving?
I want to move on to school finance for me in a minute, but I want to hear from Mark on this. This is a point of contention between the two of you. So I want to hear, one, Dave says there's money in the system. And would you, Dave, I just want to be clear about this. You think there's plenty of money. We don't need any more money in the system.
There's no question that we need to maybe make a lot better use of a lot of the money in the system.
That's not what I'm asking. You think there's, at $6 billion, you think that we're good?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, Mark, I want to hear you on that. And I know KESB has done a lot of work on where Kansas achievement is. So address those two things for me.
Well, I think there actually is a lot of discussion about achievement, and I absolutely agree there should be. And I was thinking about what I was going to say today. I kind of reminded myself that I actually got appointed to a local school board a number of years ago when my first youngest kids were very young. And I did so because I thought we needed to improve our schools. It wasn't that long after the Nation at Risk report. I was concerned about what their future would look like. And after working for KASB for over 25 years, for working with great leaders around the state, I still think we have to do better, because what I've learned in going back at this is there has always been a crisis in public education. There has always been a sense we really better get on the stick because what we expect our schools to do continues to grow. I mean, one of the things that surprised me when I went to work for KASB, because I don't know what I necessarily thought about in the past, but our research director pointed out it wasn't until the mid-60s that 50% of the U.S. population had completed high school. And if you kind of think about the common school movement starting 100 years before that, it kind of took us 100 years to get to 50%. We're now at 90. Used to be that college was for maybe the top 5%. We're now expecting at 50, 60, 70%. So, and Dave and I have lots of conversations around this, why we believe, and I believe, there's not enough money in the system, is because we're continuing to ask the system to do more.
Well, address for me, though, the notion of how you think Kansas kids are doing academically. Dave suggests that there is that they're not doing as well as they can, but your research would perhaps suggest something else, correct?
Well, what we did this summer, and we've done this before, is look at Kansas' performance on a number of national indicators, and putting those all together, and that includes not just our overall performance, but subgroups of kids, we are a top 10 state. We are the 10th state by this measure, and of course, you could tweak those indicators. We've always tended to rank high. I only hasten to say, that doesn't mean we're good enough. Every state is facing the same challenge, the need to get more kids to higher levels of education, better preparation. So, you know, the good news is we compare pretty favorably. You know, bad news is all the indications are that's still not going to be good enough. We have to continue to get better.
Dave, I want a quick response to that.
Okay, so you've probably, a lot of folks have heard, because I've certainly read it in the media and heard it not only from Mark's group, but others, that Kansas has some of the best achievement in the nation. Is that a fair, that's what you've heard? And you just heard Mark say that we're number 10 in the nation. But we don't have a single ranking in the top 10. Every single NAEP ranking, I have them right here, are in the mid-teens or the high teens to the mid-30s. Every single ACT ranking is in the 20s. We don't rank number 10 in anything when you look at, and this is whether you look at low-income kids or those who are not low-income. On NAEP, you look at reading and math. ACT doesn't publish income strata, but they publish only by race. We're not top 10 in anything. And even if we were top 10, now see, Mark has his, they have their own proprietary formula, and they count some things in that don't really measure actual achievement, like a high school graduation rate. You know, it's good that we're graduating more kids, but are they college and career ready? Our own state assessment says not even close. Our state assessments, the last one that was published, said that only, and this is 10th grade is as far as it goes, only 11% of the low-income kids in the 10th grade are on track to be college and career ready. 11% in the 10th grade. The group that is not low-income, only 32% of them are on track to be college and career ready. All the rest need varying degrees of remedial training. So it might make the schools feel better and certainly make some citizens feel better to think that we're top 10, but we aren't.
I'll concede. We also look at graduation rate because I think that is an important threshold, and we look at participation in college by young adults, and you're right. There's one or two where we're in the top 10 of those areas, but on average we score that high because many of the states that may do better than us on one measure are much lower on another. And so I guess the question becomes, our view is we need to look at the results of the whole system. And the only thing where I think we've disagreed before is we think we need to look broader than NAEP scores and ACT scores as well.
Gentlemen, that's where we're going to have to leave it. This is where we turn the podcast over to you. And you are going to nominate songs about what our walk-off music is going to be. Now, normally, I would be the sole decider of what we're going to do that. But because we have an audience in here, I'm going to put it to them. Dave Traubert, what's your song?
Sheryl Crow's Every Day is a Winding Road.
Mark Tallman?
Bruce Springsteen, Thunder Road.
Sheryl Crow. The Boss.
A lot of Boss fans.
Bruce Springsteen, Thunder Road it is. Gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for being here. You guys were terrific. State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp and Mike Russo tonight. A huge thanks to the great folks here at the Johnson County Library here in Overland Park for their help. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you get your podcast. Our friends over there on UpToDate make a little room for us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. If you're a fan of the Twitter, you can follow me. I'm at Sam Zeff. My co-host Brian Ellison on State House Blend Missouri is at PTS Brian. Thank you all for being here tonight at the Johnson County Public Library. I'm Sam Zeff. I'll see you around the radio.
It sure is.
So you're scared and you're thinking that maybe we ain't that young anymore. Show a little faith, there's magic in the night. You ain't a beauty, but hey, you're all right. Oh, and that's all right with me. You can hide with your covers and study your pain, because the lover's throws as a rain. Waste your summer praying in vain for a savior to rise from these streets. Well, I know you're all that's understood. All the attention I've been off a girl is beneath this dirty hood. With a chance to make it somehow.
To keep up with the latest political happenings in Topeka, search for State House Blend Kansas on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, be sure to subscribe to State House Blend Missouri as well. On Wednesday, flying cars, finally. And we'll speak with author, foreign correspondent, and one of the top 100 global thinkers. That's Robert Kaplan. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.